All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 060933, Southwestern Bell Telephone LP, DBA SBC Texas versus Harris County Toll Road Authority and Harris County from Harris County and the First Court of Appeals District. Docket number 061071, State Farm Lloyds versus Becky Ann Johnson from Collin County and the Fifth Court of Appeals District. And docket number 070010, Galveston Central Appraisal District versus TRQ Captain's Landing LP and American Housing Foundation from Galveston County and the First Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each argument and expects to complete all three before noon. We will take a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 060933, Southwestern Bell Telephone versus Harris County Toll Road Authority.
Please the court. Mr. Hatchell will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This is a suit by Southwestern Bell to recover utility relocation costs that were incurred when Harris County forced Southwestern Bell to relocate its utilities when Harris County and Harris County Toll Road Authority wanted to build the West Park Toll Road. Southwestern Bell's theories of liability were two. First is that sections of the transportation code permitted it to recover its relocation costs. And the second is, barring that, or perhaps even parallel to that, the Constitution and the Takings Clause particularly would classify the interest taken as property, and therefore we would have a takings claim. As to the first of those theories, the Court of Appeals held that we did not show that the state was immune from suit. And as to the second of those, the court held that Southwestern Bell did not have a vested property interest in the utility facilities that were taken. And we will address both this morning. I do think, however, in order to give the court an analytical framework in the time that I have this morning, the best place to start is really to look at the interest that Southwestern Bell has in its facilities, because our two theories of recovery in one sense are sort of joined at the hip. There is an overlap in which the nature of that interest is very important to both theories of recovery. And so let us look at that interest very carefully, because there is, quite frankly, a confusing panoply of cases and statutes and patchwork statutes here and there that can lead one into a state of confusion, Justice Norville's Serbonian bog. And I would hope to try to give some illumination to that this morning.
Well, does the nature of the interest affect the waiver question?
Probably not, but yes and no, Your Honor, because there are two aspects of the waiver question. One would be waiver as to liability, and waiver as to immunity from suit. Probably does not affect the latter, But there is a certain aspect of the nature of our interest that, and I don't think Your Honor is going to have any problem with the waiver of immunity from liability. The beginning point in the analysis begins with the statute under which we have the right to locate. And it's very, very important to understand the nature of the ownership of highways in Texas. The state owns the highways. It is true that counties and municipalities have control over highways, oftentimes through police power and oftentimes through delegation from statutes. But the state itself is the one that ultimately owns the highways, and any lesser governmental entity is simply acting as a trustee. Southwestern Bell gets its right to locate by direct statute from the state, and I think that distinguishes it in many respects. We've given the court a handout, which we hope will trace the nature of the interest in a very logical form for you. So the beginning portion is section 181.082 of the Texas Utilities Code, which says that a telephone or telegraph corporation may install a facility of the corporation acting along or across a public road or interest in a manner that does not inconvenience the public in the use of that road. It's important to notice there are no qualifications on that grant.
There is a significant one, and that is inconvenience of the public.
No. Well, yes and no. That qualification is an assertion of basic police power in the original location of the facilities. If you will notice, the very last phrase talks about in the use of the road. The prior version of the statute said in the use of such road. I think what Your Honor will find is once we comply with the minimal police power requirements of either the municipality or the county, and we accept the invitation to locate our facilities there, the interest ripens into a vested property interest.
Well, I mean, that begs the question, because if it's subject to the not inconveniencing the public, isn't the fact that they have to build a roadway, a tollway, and expand West Park, doesn't that mean that if they don't make that expansion, the public's inconvenienced?
I don't think that's the proper construction. The inconvenience to the public, again, I say, is, for example, we could not locate our poles in the middle of an intersection in the original location. That would certainly be an inconvenience to the public.
Well, I mean, what's your authority that requiring expansion, or let's say not allowing expansion, would inconvenience the public? I mean, I understand how you're reading it, but what's your authority for that?
Well,
Our
authority for that is, if you will follow along on the outline, in the very next paragraph on nature of interest. The privilege of using the streets for railway purposes is a franchise, the important part. The actual occupation of the streets for railroad purposes by virtue of ordinance is an easement. But even more pertinent, in the Centerpoint case, the result of a telephone company investing its money by placing its fixtures in a public right-of-way, subject to the initial control under the police power, has the highest authority been held to be the vesting of a property right to be protected as such under constitutional guarantees. Granted, we must locate in accordance with the guidelines exercised through the police power when we initially install. But once our right becomes vested, in many, many cases from this court, from the United States Supreme Court, from the federal authorities say, that state government cannot backtrack on that offer and that acceptance.
Is it true that at common law facilities like Southwestern Bell, who was required to relocate its utilities, had to do so at its own expense?
Your Honor, it is true that there are cases that will identify what is called the general common law rule. I would suggest to Your Honor that the common law rule is actually the minority rule. The exceptions to that rule have basically swallowed up the common rule to the point that it's of very little importance. Those exceptions being two. One, if there is a statute which defines the nature of the right, that dispenses with the common law rule. And if you'll notice in a footnote in the Centerpoint opinion, if you're dealing with a vested property interest, that also displaces the common law rule.
Well, in looking at the statute then, it seems to me your position would be a lock if the legislature is provided, as it does in the Transportation Code, that the authority shall pay the cost of installation of the facility in a new location. But this statute that we're talking about here, 251-102, doesn't have that same provision. So if we are to construe a statute in derogation of the common law, you know, that says at your expense, why would we read this provision expansively to, in effect, incorporate the Transportation Code's rule?
Well, and I think it all goes back to the nature of the grant from the state being the owner of the facilities in this case, has given us a vested property interest, so that when you look down to Section 251-102, that becomes very, very important. It says a county shall include the cost of relocating or adjusting an eligible utilities facility in the expense of right-of-way acquisition.
If that statute said the opposite, if it said that the utility had to pay relocation expense, would you still have a vested interest in it?
We would not, Your Honor, for this reason. Assuming that statute was the initial invitation, and I'm not certain that it is, but I want to try to answer your question in the context of the way I understand. If the initial invitation by statute has a condition attached to it whereby you must pay utility costs, and there are many of those in Texas, then no, we would not have the right. We would have located with the condition that we would always be subject to ouster as a result of removal of the costs.
So your argument that this is a protected property interest of some sort depends on how it was, what conditions accompanied its creation, and so on.
You've made the point obviously much better than I have in the entire opening of my argument, because the point being, because our right comes directly from the state in 181.082 without condition, numerous cases have established that that is a vested property interest, contrasted to other utilities which take and locate under statutes which from the very beginning state that they they must pay utility relocation costs or in some other manner have a condition attached.
And if that's so, then your remedy here, your ability to sue, is based on the statute's provision that on which statute's provision? Let me ask it that way.
Well,
where's the right to sue come from?
Well, of course, the right to sue, we think, begins with the code provisions which give us the right to sue the county for a debt. We think that Section 251-102, if you look at the words cost, include the cost of relocating, creates a debt. The rationale being that in a statute like ours, when the state has given us an unconditional right and the county wishes to acquire the property, it acquires the property subject to our right. So the word cost in Section 251-102, we think, creates a debt that allows us to sue.
And yet in the city of Sunset Valley case, the legislature said adequate compensation shall be made, and we held that immunity was not waived, even in that circumstance, because it didn't the statute didn't expressly provide a cause of action. And how
yes,
is this,
of course,
how does this
course, distinguish? Course, and it's a very, very excellent point, Your Honor, but in the city of Sunset Valley, what was happening there was they were trying to seek the cost of a substitute road. And I don't recall, it's very, very important in these cases to look at the origin of the title. And frankly, I don't remember precisely what the, I believe in that case it was the city's right. I can't remember its origin as to whether it was unconditional. But what I would think would be that in City and Sunset Valley, since the state owns the streets to begin with, that they did not have the vested property interest that is necessary in this case. And also, they were not seeking an ouster. In a sense, I guess, they were seeking an ouster, but what they were really seeking was the cost of building a substitute road. And I think clearly that the decision in that case was absolutely correct. The other thing, Your Honor, that I would point out about 251-102, which is a sense that you get when you finally read all the cases together, are in the words, in the expense of right-of-way location. It seems to me that that phrase in particular makes 251-102 the functional equivalent of a takings claim. And for that reason,
Before
Your Honor,
you go there, let me, after Took, the Took case, you still believe that 251-102 is a clear and unequivocal waiver of immunity?
I think that after Took, that the statutes are a waiver of immunity under the factors that this court has identified. Clearly, we don't have express language. There's just no question that we don't have that.
Which puts you on the upside of the hill from the beginning.
Absolutely. We're fighting uphill.
Okay, well, take us up that hill.
Let me, Your Honor, I have 3 seconds, and I can answer your question with permission from the court. I can give you 5 factors that I think will establish why we believe there's a waiver of immunity in this case. First, factor number one, we think 251-102 clearly imposes an obligation to pay when Harris County, or HCTRA, opts to take the property knowing that we have an unconditional right to be there. So we get liability pursuit out of the way. The second factor, which goes to suit immunity, is, as I said earlier, we believe 251-102 is the functional equivalent of property and tantamount to an inverse condemnation claim, which, and as the court knows, inverse condemnation is free from the claim of governmental immunity. And so we really think when the court gets a bird's eye view of all of these statutes, the reason there is no express waiver is because the legislature has also assumed that these are either takings claims or the functional equivalent of takings claims. And factor number three, which actually has subparts and is the last factor, the brief that was filed in State versus City of Austin has a marvelous historical perspective, and I brought it and we'll leave it with the court, that identifies over 40 statutes in which the state of Texas has provided for the recovery of utility relocation costs. We believe that that establishes a basic public policy of the state. We believe that it's a very, very important concept, that in 251-102 and the whole panoply of cases.
Mr. Hatcher, you may want to wrap up.
I'm going to, and this is just but probably the most important point I'll make. The legislature wanted to get money to the utilities so as not to burden taxpayers with the cost of building highways. Our construction of 251-102 is a perfect example of proper allocation of those costs. The cost of building a highway is put upon the people who build the highways and the users. If we get our utility relocation costs, the cost is put. We don't have to pass on the cost of building highways to our ratepayers.
Thank you, Mr. Hatchell. Are there further questions? The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Powers will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court.
The first topic I want to discuss with you this morning is the proper construction of Section 251.102 of the Transportation Code. I think in order to determine what the proper construction is, we have to look at the predecessor statutes on which this current statute was built. The first statute was Article 6674-3. That statute was passed in 1963, apparently in response to a Fifth Circuit opinion concerning a case involving Hardin County. Hardin County had agreed with a utility that it would, actually it was a pipeline, I believe, that agreed that they would pay anything they were legally obligated to pay with respect to relocation costs. The Fifth Circuit determined that because the Texas statutes precluded that county from paying for anything in connection with the construction of state highways after the creation of the Texas Highway Department, that it could not be legally obligated to pay the relocation costs because they weren't a part of the cost of acquisition of right-of-way. And so the statute was passed by the legislature to declare expressly that relocation costs were a part of the acquisition costs for right-of-way. Subsequent to that time, in 1983, the legislature passed Article 6702-1, which included Section 4.303. This statute was the County Road and Bridge Act. That Section 4.303 said that the county should include the cost of relocation of utilities in the cost of acquisition of right-of-way.
And you didn't do that. Did you do that?
In this particular instance?
Yes.
No, sir.
Why doesn't SBC have a vested property interest here? It certainly seems like they do.
Well, they go into possession of the property pursuant to 181.082 of the Utilities Code. That provision says that they may lay their lines in the public right-of-way so long as doing so does not inconvenience the public in the use of the road.
So they risk their investment subject to the growth of a particular county?
Well, they undertake the risk. They, you know, utilities know that if they place their lines in a public right-of-way free of charge, that they may be called upon at some point in time to move that line so as to not inconvenience the public in use of the road. If it's necessary to change a traffic lane or improve the roadbed in order to accommodate changes that must be made.
And what does inconvenience of the public mean? Do you agree with Mr. Hatchell's definition of what inconveniences the public?
No, I do not, because what he's saying is that if it doesn't inconvenience the public when you first place the line in a specific location, that's the end of the inquiry. And I submit that the proper construction of the wording of the statute is that you always have to consider whether or not it's going to inconvenience the public if the line must remain in that specific location.
If you were going to say that, you'd use some word other than install.
Well,
telephone corporation may install in a way that is not inconvenient. But the fact that it becomes inconvenient 50 years later doesn't seem to, you would think, install so that it would never be inconvenient, or if it ever became inconvenient, you'd have to pay for it or something other than just that.
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that sometimes statutes are not worded in the best possible way as they could be. But I submit to you that historically it has been recognized always throughout the United States, frankly, not just in Texas, that utilities are required to move their lines if they if it's necessary to carry out the primary purpose of the road, which is...
But that's a public policy choice, and Mr. Hatchell's last argument was they legislatures changed that. They've said you should pay for it.
Well, but they haven't waived immunity from suit at all.
Now, well, let's talk about that. So it's okay for the legislature to say, let's assume it's even clearer than it is, and says on West Park Tollway, we say Harris County taxpayers must pay for the relocation of the telephone lines, but they don't create a cause of action, then we just should ignore, we shouldn't imply from that, from their, they're saying specifically, in this case, you should pay for it. We can't imply a cause of action from that. We should just say, well, sorry, because you didn't say no suit, in fact, they don't pay for it.
Well, the legislature has made it very clear that waivers of immunity are not to be simply implied unless there
right.
is.
But when they say in my hypothetical statute, on West Park Tollway, for moving the phone lines, we say Harris County must pay for it in the cost of building West Park Tollway. But they don't say anything about the suit. That's not an implied waiver.
I don't believe so, but that's not the statute we have in this case, Your Honor. This one doesn't.
It would make no sense. How else would it be done if that was their will, that Harris County should pay for the suit? Different case, hypothetical case. If that was their will, that Harris County should pay for it, Harris County says no. What other options are there than a civil suit?
Well, if the legislature doesn't grant the authority to sue, whether or not it created an obligation doesn't make a difference. It must, in other words, you have to look at the situation here about what the potential liability is for counties. You know, that's one of the factors the court always looks at. Is there, if we're trying to find an implied waiver of immunity, is there some limitation placed by the statute upon the potential liability of the government?
Speaking of that limitation, does it matter that they already owned the right-of-way rather than this being a cost in its acquisition?
Does it matter that the county already owned
the right-of-way rather than this being a cost of its acquisition? Because the statute says the county shall include the cost in the expense of right-of-way acquisition. And my understanding was your position was we already had it.
That's right. The state of Texas owned that right-of-way, as it owns all the roads in Texas. And the county was simply authorized by statute to make use of state property when it constructs a project of this nature. That's a part of the transportation code.
Are you troubled at all by the Centerpoint decision from the Fifth Circuit? It would appear that they've allowed reimbursement to Centerpoint on the same project. If we were to hold differently, then does that result trouble you a little bit, that the result depends upon whether you're in federal court or state court?
Not in the slightest, Your Honor, because the Fifth Circuit got it wrong. And this, I'm sure that this court is going to get it right about what is the proper construction of 251.102.
But right or wrong, one of us will be right or wrong. I mean, if you had differing decisions, isn't it somewhat troubling that one utility gets reimbursed and another one doesn't?
Well, then the law will be established, because this is the court that establishes what the Texas law is, not the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit made its best guess about what this court would hold, and I submit that it got it wrong. It got it wrong because it did not. It based its decision upon the City of Austin analysis that this court used.
But just so we don't leave Justice Brister's point, one other aspect of that. I know you have an argument about eligible utility facility and how that was construed. But if you're wrong about that, if the circuit and the Court of Appeals are correct about that, you're still not going to pay.
That's right.
That's a little troubling that even though there's no cause of action, the government would just snub its lawful responsibilities because there's nothing the citizen can do about it.
Well, I don't think that the purpose of the statute was to create a debt on the part of the government. It was to establish that If the utility actually is an eligible utility, as that term has always been understood in Texas, then it's appropriate for the government to make a reimbursement. Now,
but you say you won't, even if it is an eligible utility facility.
Well, now certainly the government is going to honor its obligations.
Well, that's what I was asking about.
Okay, well, I misunderstood, Your Honor. I
mean, no, because you couldn't be sued, and therefore you weren't going to do it.
If the government actually had an obligation to do this, then the government would honor its obligations, I would think.
Does it actually have an obligation under the Transportation Code 366 that the authority shall pay the cost of installation of the facility in a new location?
No, I don't think it does, not in this instance, because here's the thing. there's no eligible utility involved in this situation. SBC.
Well, under the circumstance where that provision would apply, 366, and the authority shall pay the cost of installation, does that waive immunity or does it not?
366?
Of the transportation code. 366.171B. Mentioned in the I thought your brief, but certainly in Southwestern Bells.
Well, 366.171.
I'm not
completely different statute.
I'm not trying to apply it to your client, to Harris County. In this case, I'm saying, as a matter of waiver of immunity, if you have a statute that says that the authority shall pay the cost of relocation, is that a waiver of immunity from suit?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because you still have to determine the usual factors, such as is there a limitation on the exposure of the government.
If Southwestern Bell here had refused to relocate, said we're not going to do it until you hand us a check, then what would have happened?
Well, I suppose that there would have been litigation over whether they were obligated to move or not.
You'd have had to sue.
I suppose we would have had to sue. And the problem with having doing that, of course, would be that we would waive immunity from suit in the process.
So it would behoove the utility to be adamant.
Well, that wouldn't end the matter. That would take out one defense, the immunity from suit. It would not create a vested property interest in them, and it would not create a legal obligation to pay as the statute is worded. One of the things, getting back to the CenterPoint case and what's wrong with that decision, the Fifth Circuit utilized this court's criteria for constitutionality of the legislature authorizing reimbursement to a private party when the state exercises its police power. There was no eligibility for reimbursement was undisputed in City of Austin. That was, you know, eligibility was not the issue, and yet that's the criteria that the Fifth Circuit determined was how you determine what is an eligible utility facility. And that cannot be right. And the other aspect of it that needs to be kept in mind is there was no assertion of immunity from suit in the CenterPoint case. The county
which doesn't matter because it can't be waived.
The county
court has to take it up even if the parties don't raise it.
Well, but the problem is under federal law, if the county removes the suit from state court to federal court, it waives its immunity from suit. That's established federal law. And so we were not in a position to assert immunity from suit in the Fifth Circuit or in the federal litigation.
Except you didn't have to remove it.
Right. Sorry?
Except you didn't have to remove it.
Well, that's true. We didn't have to remove it, but it was removed, and when it was removed.
Now you wish you had.
Well, I think that's correct, Your Honor. It would have been a lot better not to have removed that case.
The right-of-way is provided free to the utilities, but taxed.
Yes, sir. That's
so
true.
Why is that not a property interest? You can't tax somebody if they don't have on something they don't have a property interest in.
Well, there's not any requirement in the tax code that the interest that they have, whatever of whatever nature it may be, there's no requirement that it be a vested property right. Well, but only vested property rights can support a taking claim.
So what interest are you taxing? What do you tax?
Well, I think it's being taxed in different ways around the state, frankly, probably.
What do you tax?
Well, the record doesn't reflect it one way or the other. I believe what they're taxing is the value of the lines installed in the ground, but I can't make a specific representation of the court on that because the record doesn't reflect it.
Value of the lines to a user or the value of the cables and conduits?
Well, I think it's the market value of the lines in place. They take into account perhaps What did it cost to put them in there, and you know, what benefit can you gain from them? Could
right. If that's owned by Verizon, if that's owned by SBC, you can make money off of that. That's a property right.
But that doesn't make it a vested property right, because if it were vested, then it would inconvenience the public. That's the difference.
There's the statement in your brief, 14 to 15, you say, thus a utility is eligible to receive reimbursement only when the project in question is, one, eligible for federal participation, or two, the utility has a compensable property interest in the land. I put in the one and the two. Is it either or? Is that what you mean, or do you mean that it must be eligible for federal participation no matter what?
Oh, no, I don't mean that at all. I mean, federal participation is just an aspect of how there could be an eligible utility, because, you know, that's what we had in the City of Austin case back in 1960. The project was eligible for federal funding, and so in that class of cases, then you have an eligible utility. The other aspect, of course, is did the utility have a private easement before the government came along to acquire the right-of-way? If you acquire their property, then they are eligible.
So when Mr. Hatchell says today that there's some relationship here between the nature of the property interest and the statute, this sort of identifies part of that relationship, that you would say utility is eligible if there was a compensable property interest in the land.
That's right. Yeah. But it must predate the government's acquisition of the right-of-way. And that's another point that I want to get to before my time runs out. Many of the cases that are relied upon by SBC in support of their position that they have a vested right in this right-of-way are cases that involve franchise agreements. Those are completely different than what we have here in this case. They're totally distinguishable. Franchise law is based in contract. The parties, the government and the utility, enter into an agreement for the placement of the lines. The utility gives valuable consideration to place those lines there. It creates, once they go into possession and place their lines there, they create vested rights. That's not what we have in this case. So the Owensboro case, the City of Louisville case, the City of El Paso case, all those cases are franchise cases, and they're completely distinguishable from what we have here.
What would have happened if the county had told the utility, no, you can't locate your lines in this right-of-way? Wouldn't then the phone company, in this case, or any other utility, be required to purchase an easement or some other way of locating their line somewhere?
Well, if the county told a utility that they could not place their line in the public right-of-way in the face of the statute that gives them the right to do so.
It says may.
Well, but, I mean, it's been interpreted to mean that you must allow them to be there. And if you don't, then you'd be subject to suit for injunction to force you to allow that to occur.
It seems to me that this sort of thing's been going on around the state for years. I mean, people, utilities, or counties, cities, relocating utilities and streets, reconstruction, and so forth. Why is this case different from those in some way, and why is this surfacing now? Is it something new about this situation that makes it come up now?
Well, I think historically the utilities have always paid their own relocation costs because the law has been clearly established that they must do so. I think probably what's happened here is that in recent times the utilities are not permitted to pass on the cost of changing those lines to their ratepayers, and it's going to the bottom line, and they're looking for somebody else to pay for it. That's my supposition as to what's happening here. But, I mean, historically, the utilities have always paid their own relocation costs, and that's been true throughout the United States.
Harris County's involved in this. It was in the CenterPoint case. What about other counties and cities? We don't see any litigation involving those. I wonder why that is.
Well, I'm not aware of any litigation yet, but I think what's happening is the utilities are beginning to take the position that the government must pay the relocation costs, and they're basing it on
the regional tollway statute they win.
Tollways, in the regional tollway statute, there is, you know, actually a provision for granting them reimbursement. And but the, there's a point
so
that
they win.
Well,
if this was under the regional tollway, you would lose.
No, because here's the reason. And I'm about to run out of time, but I'll answer your questions. Keep letting me. You have to look at that tollway statute. It says that the payment must come from the revenue of the operation of the tollway. It does not create an obligation to the credit against the credit of the state of Texas or against the county that created the tollway. And so that it does not create liability on the part of the county. It's a red herring to say that the Turnpike statute is like this. It's different, but it also is limited such that the only obligation is the obligation to pay out of the revenues from the operations, not the county's credit.
If I could have just one.
Yes, sir.
Of course, the whole idea of a tollway is that the users will pay for it. And your position is the users should not pay for this cost.
Well, the county shouldn't pay for it, because the county hasn't been obligated by the...
If the county doesn't pay for it, the tollway users aren't either.
Well, what's going to happen is that ultimately the utility, which the legislature has determined is the party to pay...
I'll take that as a
pay.
No.
Yes.
Correct.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Powers.
Thank you.
Did you cover all five of your points earlier? We didn't get to the takings clause, Your Honor, which I can do, but I would like very much to get to 4 points. The interesting dilemma that is posed by opposing counsel's excellent argument is stark and striking. They say, when we want to tax you and get money from you, we will call your interest a vested property interest. But when you want to get money from us, what is it? It's a puff of smoke. It's a franchise, a special privilege, a license. They just simply can't have it both ways. So there are 4 points that I would like to address in rebuttal. One is that utilities always know when they locate their facilities in a right-of-way that they're subject to paying utility relocation costs. That's just absolutely untrue. The handout that we have given you contains direct quotations from cases which simply refute that, one of which being, if the right to maintain the company's poles, wires, and conduits on the streets of Fort Worth is property for purposes of protection, it's property for purposes of taxation. And when we have the right, unconditional right to locate, subject simply to minimal police power, we don't know that we're going to be taxed on relocation costs when the cases tell us that when we accept that invitation and sink our poles, we have a vested property interest and government can't take it away from us. The second point that I would like to address is the question of the inconvenience limitation, which Justice O'Neill has very appropriately raised. Justice O'Neill, that's best addressed in the City of Fort Worth case by out of the Fifth Circuit. And he made this very cogent observation. The reservation of the by the statute of a supervision through the municipality as to the placing and alteration of the fixture does not negative its operation when acted on as a grant or dedication. So I think that harmonizes the relationship between our interest and the exercise of police power. The next point that I want to make has to do with the statement that all of our cases have to do with franchises. In looking at the cases, I would caution the court to be very careful at the court's uses of various phrases. There are a number of ways in which courts have called our interests, one being a contractual franchise, which is exactly the type of interest that I'm talking about. We accept a contract. I mean, we accept your offer to locate. It initially starts out as a franchise, but once we accept it, it becomes a contractual franchise and a contractual right. And the cases are, in our judgment, very, very clear that in our particular situation, when we have an unconditional right to locate, we accept that. We sink our poles because the beginning of all of this litigation was to encourage the expansion of telephone and telegraph service within Texas, and that's why they were willing to give us the property interest that we did. And, Mr. Justice Willett, that leads me to our taking stand. I think that if the court doesn't buy into our argument under the statute, which we have emphasized because we believe the court doesn't, well, would prefer not to write on the Constitution if it has a statutory escape, we still say that the answer is exactly as we have just given you. And do we have a vested property right that is a compensable property right? And we believe that we have given you cases that say that we do.
Well, the Court of Appeals analysis, I think, was fairly interesting because they seem to say a vested property right has to be an interest in the real estate itself.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, they made the point, it can't be a mere expectancy that a particular law will continue.
Well, the cases have said that our, in fact, I believe this case has said, and did you read this case in the city of Austin described it as an easement. And the United States Supreme Court has described it as an easement. But whatever the nature.
You're not claiming it's an easement in the sense that we typically use that as an ownership interest in the property.
Oh, absolutely.
But, I mean, you couldn't transfer that interest. You couldn't sell
it. I think
that,
oh, yes. As a matter of fact, also the two United States Supreme Court cases that are cited in our brief say this is not only a property interest, but it is, when it becomes vested, is alienable. I mean, how are, for example, utility companies who merge with one another going to be able to transfer these interests one to the other if they're not alienable?
Well, that doesn't relate to whether it's, I mean, whoever you transfer it to is going to get whatever right you've had. That sort of begs the question.
But if the cases are correct in saying that once we establish a location, the government cannot take it away from us, I'm not sure that it makes a whole lot of difference what we call it, because if we can't be deprived of it, it is certainly property that is subject to, in my judgment, not only the statute, but taking claim. And Your Honor, my clock is not working. I may
yes. Are there, ask on the court staff. Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Hatchell. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.